Well, good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen, and a very warm welcome to everyone who's here today to hear our most distinguished speaker. First of all, I would like to give apologies to you from the president of the Friends of the Library, Oliver Mayo, who unfortunately is not able to be with us today. And we also have apologies from the university librarian, Ray Choate, who often manages to make some of these meetings but is not able to today. Just a small reminder, if anyone hasn't turned off their mobile phone, could they please do so, so that we're not disturbed during the proceedings. It's my very great pleasure to introduce today to you John Emerson. John, who is to be our speaker. Now, John is a graduate, he's currently the director of the Adelaide University Press, or University of Adelaide Press, give it its correct title. His formal studies were in French, specialising in cinema, and he has a postgraduate degree from the Université de Paris, the Sorbonne Nouvelle, and also a PhD from Adelaide, comparing French and Australian representatives of colonial history in contemporary cinema. Our topic today, though, is a bit removed from cinema. John has has been commissioned to write a series of books on South Australian legal history, and so he is currently based in the law school of this university. He's published numerous articles and so far has published two books on legal history of South Australia, and he is today going to talk to us about the third book, which is not yet completed. He says next year, with a question mark. He's researching and writing a biography of John Bray, whom I'm sure many people here will remember as our Chief Justice a number of years ago. So thank you very much, John, and we look forward to hear what you have to say to us.
Usually discovery events emphasise the contribution of the Barsmith's collections to a particular project. John Bray left the bulk of his papers to the State Library of South Australia, and so most of my library work is spent there. But I think we can justify today's talk about John Bray simply by the fact that he was probably the most frequent user of the Barsmith Library in all its history. Biographies outside of those on US presidents and other people with international profiles are not generally encouraged by publishers. So today I'd like to talk about why I chose John Bray for a biography and what I hope to achieve, and finish up by showing you one of his most important papers, a private one, that illustrates the challenge of writing about his life. John Bray will be officially recorded in history for being Chief Justice of South Australia from 1967 to 1978. And Chancellor of the University of Adelaide from 1968 to 1983. As Chief Justice over 11 years, he produced 600 reported judgments, and some of them continue to be cited in courts across Australia, including the High Court. After hours, he read, shared many drinks in the hotels of the City of Adelaide with his friends, and became a poet. He published 5 or 6 volumes of poetry, and many individual poems in other publications. He was a founding member of the Adelaide Festival of Arts, and his literary friendships included Nancy Cato, Max Harris, Geoffrey Dutton, Brian Medlin, Peter Ward, Christopher Pearson, Colin Tierley, and many, many others. The John Bray Law Network of the Alumni Association commissioned me originally to write a book on the history of the Chief Justices of South Australia, with a chapter on each South Australian Chief Justice who completed their term in the 20th century. So Samuel Way in 1916, George Murray, 1942, Melis Napier, 1967, John Bray, 1978, and Len King, 1995. I wrote the book in reverse order to take advantage, firstly, of the fact that Len King, who had succeeded John Bray as Chief Justice, was the only Chief Justice still living and could advise me on the interpretation of the office. Secondly, there were colleagues and friends of John's still living. One of these was John's close friend, Brian Medlin, former Professor of Philosophy at Flinders University. I drove out to Brian's property beyond Horsham in Victoria in late 2002, so right at the very start of the whole project, only initially to speak with him about the single chapter in the book on the Chief Justices. I recorded 8 hours of interview that night and not finishing until the early hours of Sunday morning. That interview gave me an unprecedented insight into John, and I was captivated. I decided that I might attempt a book-length work once I published the other two books that I was doing at the time. The one on the Chief Justices, which was titled First Among Equals, and The History of the South Australia's Independent Bar. But rarely is anything what it seems. Unknowingly, the interview with Brian in 2002 had caused a lot of stress for him and for John's other surviving close friend, Peter Ward. It took several years before Peter would feel confident enough to allow me access to the most crucial of John's papers, which were not left at the State Library. It was then that I saw the email correspondence between Peter and Brian about that interview some 6 years earlier. I could see how worried they were about the intrusion into their lives of someone they did not know at all. They were anxious especially about how I'd treat John. This was a revelation on the reality of writing a biography. It genuinely can be prying into the most intimate details of someone's life, and as a result, into the life of their peers and friends and relatives. So you need to have justification for doing this and tread with respect. By the time I had found this out, Susan Mitchell had published her tabloid-style book on the Snowtown murders in Adelaide, and she had interviewed Pam Cleland, one of John's closest remaining friends, as well as Peter Ward. The shabby treatment of Pam added to the suspicion among John's surviving friends as to what I might do. There were moments of self-doubt, but I hoped that my motive was genuinely to provide an account of the life of a unique and good-willed man, fiercely independent, who was dedicated to the long-term principles of Western civilization and its literature and concept of justice. And by long-term, I mean all the way back to Rome. John was born in Wayville on 16th of September 1912, 99 years tomorrow. I'm hoping to complete his biography for his centenary next year. Very important to his birth was the fact John was born into a wealthy Adelaide family. The ultimate source of the Bray money is a shipping fortune. John's great-grandfather, Tom Cox Bray, arrived in Adelaide around 1840 and set up as a shoemaker, then called a cordwainer. But Tom's own grandfather, Charles, made a fortune shipping goods between Britain and Australia. And around 1860, Charles left Tom his money. Tom modified his life, you could say. He closed his cordwainer shop and sailed promptly back to England to become a gentleman. He left his teenage son, John Cox Bray, at the newly founded St. Peter's College. John Cox Bray, John's grandfather, went on to become a lawyer, an MP, and in 1881, Premier of South Australia. 1881 was also the year his father, Tom, died over in England and passed on that shipping fortune. So the Premier's modest house on Hutt Street was extended into an Italian mansion with the architectural assistance of George Strickland Kingston. And later, John Cox Bray bought shares in the Adelaide Arcade, still to this day owned by members of the Bray family. On the other side of John's family were the Stowes, who claimed Pocahontas as one of their ancestors, together with American President Thomas Jefferson, after whom John is named. Randolph Stowe was one of the first three Queen's Counsel appointed in South Australia in 1861 and later became a Supreme Court judge. So as a fourth or fifth generation South Australian both sides, with a Premier as a grandfather, a great uncle, a Supreme Court judge, even a church founded by the Stowes on North Terrace, John was blue blood Adelaide. He certainly must have appreciated the family situation he was born into, as he never left home. Only after his mother's death in 1970 did he finally leave Hutt Street, and that was only under sibling pressure. Surprisingly, John did not get along well at all with his father, whom his brother Bill once described as a man who got all his information about the world from Reader's Digest. Harry Bray had failed at medical school, and after various business ventures called himself a stockbroker. He luckily had the backup of the family and connections, but seemed to have harboured bitter feelings about his career failings. According to John's younger brother Bill, Harry was ferociously hypercritical of all his three children. Rowena was born in 1919 and Bill was born in 1923. Both left home as soon as they could. Bill lived overseas all his adult life and only died in France recently. Rowena travelled widely and settled in Sydney. But John became entirely impervious to his father's opinions. The house on Hutt Street had around 18 main rooms, and so it was big enough for him to live in a separate wing. John was, however, very close to his mother. The year after John died, his brother Bill wrote to Peter Ward saying, "John and Gertrude were wholly entwined. She loved him unstintingly, with all of her usual uncritical loving nature. He, I believe, returned this love fully. She was the key to much of his lack of necessity to socialise and womanise." At school in St Peter's College, John did not really stand out. Even at Latin and English, he was often average. Part of his struggle at Saints was that he was completely disinterested in sporting activities. The origins of his disinterest may be physical. He had a serious form of short-sightedness which could not be corrected by glasses, so the world became a blur with only a few metres. He wasn't going to see a football or a tennis ball coming. He was also tone deaf, so music meant little to him. Dancing and the socialising role of it was not going to work, though he did try briefly. His natural retreat, given his physical limitations, was books, and he read far and wide. You may have heard the stories about his reading capabilities. They have entered local legend. Brian Medlin recounted John's trick in the amateur sports club. They would wait for a first-time visitor and invite them to pick a page from any book on the stack of books on the bar. John would read the page, still while drinking his beer, and recite it back verbatim. The bet was £5 if he got a word wrong. Brian also confirmed after John's Sunday reading schedule. After the regular Saturday night at the amateur sports club and then drinks at home till the early hours, John would rise at 8, read half a dozen books before lunch, and then take a half dozen more to the beach. And that might be slightly exaggerated, but you know, you get the picture. When he was on the board of the State Library, which was from 1944 to 1987, library staff put aside all the new literary books arriving. That is the 800s, for John to read before they were put on the shelves. Angela Bentley, who worked in the State Library back then, before she became a lawyer, had the job of setting some of these books aside. She followed him one day, sceptical, and she watched him reading them all in a cafe. And Peter Ward and Brian Medlin told me that John didn't read books line by line, but rather scanned the whole page at once. He taught Peter how to do it. During his first years at the University of Adelaide in the 1930s, John discovered the passions that would frame much of the rest of his life. He discovered alcohol at an after-concert party. He discovered the classics, partly through Charles Dury, who was lecturing in English at the time, and partly through another discovery, and I think it's best to quote him in his own words. So this is John. "In Latin, I discovered Catullus, an author unrepresented in the school curriculum. I was also indebted to the addition to the Lurb Classics in the State Library for an education in the bypaths of erotica. That excellent series has the Latin on the left page, the English on the right. When a particularly embarrassing passage occurred in the semia authors, like Marshall or Suetonius, the prudent editors either left the English blank or inserted a version in Italian. When you saw a blank slab or a slab in Italian, you simply looked across to the left, got out the Latin dictionary, and improved your knowledge of the language and the world. John also discovered a forgotten emperor called Gallienus, who lived in the 3rd century AD. He spent his life preparing a biography of Gallienus, only published after he died in 1995. Gallienus was as flamboyant as John was introverted. John was asked once why he studied Gallienus, and his reply was vague. "I can only say something about him and his situation made a strong appeal to me." Nicholas Rothwell reviewed Gallienus in the Australian Review of Books in 1998 and wondered if it was Bray's veiled self-portrait, an exploration often intuitive of key aspects of his own nature. There is likely to be some truth in this. If you scale down the detail of Gallienus being an emperor of Rome and John being Chief Justice of South Australia, you see a little parallel. Both played a central social role in their times, yet privately felt on the periphery. At the University of Adelaide, John took his law studies seriously. 4 of his student essays survive in his papers, and one entitled Elements of Law, John talks about the issue of whether judges make law. We've seen this question flare up recently with criticism of Chief Justice French. John, at 17 or 18 years old in 1930, had this to say: "Are we then to admit that English law is made by judges? Here we are confronted by two conflicting opinions. One, the older theory, declares that judicial decision is only a declaration and exposition of what was already the common law and which has existed from time immemorial. The law was there all the time, though not clearly discerned. On the other hand, another school, headed by Austin and Bentham, boldly declares that we must throw aside the childish fiction that judges are merely expounding a certain miraculous and intangible something, which has existed from time immemorial, and recognise that judges in fact do make new law and occupy almost, if not quite, the same function as the legislator. Somewhere between the two points of view, the truth exists." John won a Stowe Prize in 1930 and the David Murray Prize in both 1931 and 1932. He was accepted as a doctoral candidate in 1934, and in 1937 was awarded a Doctor of Laws for his thesis on bankruptcy and the winding up of companies in private international law. This was completed in 3 years while he was also working full-time as a lawyer. The Doctor of Laws was so rare an award that 30 years later, in 1968, I believe John was still its most recent recipient. He was also a highly active member of the blokey clubs that he and his friends set up to bypass Adelaide's strict liquor laws, such as the Amateur Sports Club, the Double X Club, and the Savage Club. He seemed to thrive in the company of the friends he made at school and at university, and within the strict regularity of weekly and monthly meetings. These club-based social gatherings rarely involve women, but John was very good friends with two brothers and their wives who owned farms up in the hills, and he would regularly spend bacchanalian weekends up there. There's some interesting correspondence which I have seen where they would hide liquor in the garden just in case they ran out in the house, and it's quite mischievous. This combination of working weekdays as a lawyer and spending boisterous nights and weekends socialising in the hotels and clubs would structure John's life. In between, he read and studied and began to write himself. Left to his own devices, I think John would never have travelled far from Adelaide. He probably spent 80% of his life in the CBD. But in 1937, after he was awarded the Doctor of Laws, his parents sent both him and sister Rowena for a six-month trip to Europe. Rowena was a lively 18-year-old and John had just turned 25. They travelled through England and Scotland and then to Europe. In Paris, John and Rowena saw Josephine Baker and Maurice Chevalier. In Rome, John was horrified to see Mussolini's fascist black-shirted bullies. This was a long way from Adelaide's secure conservatism. While he was away, The university awarded John de Bonython Prize for his Doctor of Laws thesis. The prize was £200, twice the average working man's income then. The donor was Sir Langdon Bonython himself, then almost 90 years old. When John returned, he wrote to the principal of St Peter's College and donated that £200 to a 12-year-old student in hardship due to the bankruptcy of his father. 1938 was still hurting from the Depression. Rowena never really came back to live in Adelaide. Over 30 years later, the family would discover that back in Europe, she had secretly married a Frenchman, later killed in the war. John was seriously rethinking his future now he was back from the Grand Tour. He wanted to become an academic, not a lawyer. For the next 10 years, he applied to universities, including Adelaide, when there were vacancies. No one offered him a post. In 1938, for example, he applied to Adelaide for the part-time lectureship in jurisprudence and Roman law, but Ralph Haig got the job. Ralph Haig's thesis for a Doctor of Laws submitted in 1936 had been rejected. John was only accepted when Ralph went to war, and only then until Ralph returned. But he did finally get the job, and he taught Roman law on Saturday mornings at the university until his eventual appointment as Chief Justice. Just as an aside, John kept the exam marks of his students. Some went on to become very well known, such as his godson Michael Abbott QC, but a couple who barely got 50% in Roman law, of them each went on also to do well. One became Attorney General twice, and one became a district court judge. But in 1938, it was in any case a key year in John's life. His old English lecturer, Charles Dury, returned to live permanently in Adelaide. Charles had lived much of his life in England and in Greece, and published the occasional collection of poetry. Charles' return would have a profound impact on John's literary life. They began meeting each Saturday morning at the now demolished South Australia Hotel after John's Roman lectures and discussed literature over the odd glass of wine. John began writing the occasional response as part of Charles Dury's regular column in the Advertiser. He also wrote occasionally for the ABC and became a regular on the radio series Information Please. Viewers would send in questions and John would be among the group of people on air who would answer them. Brian Medlin joined the Bray Dury Literary Partnership in about 1952 when he was 25, John was 40 and Charles almost 60. They decided to write a play each, and these were performed in a theatre in North Adelaide in 1955. The plays were all in blank verse, the format used more or less by Shakespeare and his contemporaries. John entitled his play Papinion, after the Roman lawyer who was executed for standing up for his principles of fairness and justice. This choice shows us the maturing of John's thought. He was now in his 40s, extremely well read, more comfortable in his legal practice, and confident enough to dramatise his ideas to a theatre audience. Papinion the man had long been forgotten then, and still. Papinion remains influential in Western history, nevertheless. He lived from 142 to 212. He was the authoritative influence on the Roman Emperor Justinian, whose codification of Roman law remains the basis of the civil law systems across continental Europe and Russia and South America. John focused on the particular dilemma Papinian found himself in at 70 years old. He had been the lifetime advisor to Roman Emperor Severus, who died in 211 and foolishly left Rome to both his sons Caracalla and Geta. Caracalla was about as well-rounded as Gaddafi, a psychopath echoing the shadow of Caligula a couple of centuries earlier. Caracalla immediately killed his brother Geta and ordered Papinian to justify this murder legally. Papinian refused. Caracalla gave him about a day to rethink his decision or be executed. That time of reflection is the play. The question is, should Papinian or anyone die for the principles of justice they believe in or yield to authority and live? Max Harris reviewed the play and found it surprisingly satisfying, given that it is 900 lines of verse. In Max's words, John's ungainly, somewhat amateurish verse worked on stage. It came over with fluidity and freedom that endowed the play with that shadowy extra dimension which integrated verse can create in drama. John himself would never quite be threatened with death in post-Rome South Australia. He would, however, be faced with the dilemma of standing up to the South Australian government 5 years later, and that was in the case he defended for Rupert Murdoch's News in 1960. The editor were charged with seditious libel over headlines and banners about the Royal Commission into the Stuart case. The case is known as R versus Rivette. Premier Playford considered that the paper had defamed the Chief Justice, Sir Melis Napier, and had to be taught who was in charge. John was now Queen's Counsel. If he had ever set his sights consciously on an appointment as a judge, he would never have taken up this case. He took it on and proved that Playford's charges were specious. There is an even higher triumph for a defence lawyer than to win a case and have a client proved not guilty. Even better is to have the charges dropped altogether partway through the case. This is what happened in R versus Rivette. Premier Playford was furious, but took it on the chin. As far as I can tell, on the other hand, former Crown Prosecutor Roderick Chamberlain, then happily appointed to the Supreme Court bench, didn't. John made an enemy. During the next 7 years, John's career as a barrister proved him one of the great advocates. Michael Abbott discussed John's impact as a barrister in A Portrait of John Bray. Michael summarised John's approach. He made a conscious decision to represent individuals whose human rights were infringed, and he ended up with a reputation for being the champion of the underdog, particularly in criminal matters. His efforts to right the wrongs and prevent injustices from occurring brought him a reputation as a fearless and most learned fighter. He became the acknowledged leader of the bar, appearing in almost every jurisdiction. He was undoubtedly the outstanding candidate for the position of Chief Justice when it became vacant. Being Chief Justice of South Australia is undoubtedly the role for which John is most officially remembered. But due to the News case, the Liberal government would probably not have appointed him, despite his family background and the fact that he voted Liberal. Besides, unofficially, the Chief Justiceship of South Australia had been promised to Roderick Chamberlain. In 1967, Premier and Attorney General Don Dunstan announced John as the next Chief Justice to replace Sir Melis Napier. Police Commissioner McKinnor raced to the Premier's office and produced patrol reports that suggested that John associated with certain types and may have engaged in homosexual acts and should not be appointed. Don Dunstan exploded. In the 7 years since the News trial in 1960, John had not been aware that he'd been under police surveillance. One of Justice Chamberlain's closest friends was Police Commissioner Brigadier McKinnor, and they both attended the same city church each Sunday. I believe Brigadier McKinnor had better things to do than to keep an eye on John. His enduring legacy as Police Commissioner includes the Academy at Force Largs and the property he donated for the Mylaw training facility, still used now. I also believe that Playford had plenty of other things to do. Was Chamberlain behind the surveillance? I do have documentation that he successfully blackballed Sir Melis Napier's application for John to become a member of the Adelaide Club. I do have documentation of Justice Chamberlain's repeated snubbing of John at functions and people apologising in writing, including the Adelaide Club president himself. I also have the document Peter Ward lent me that John wrote after seeing these police patrol reports. This document sits midstream in the 18-year period from when John defended the News in 1960. And when Don Dunstan sacked Police Commissioner Harold Salisbury in 1978 for keeping some 45,000 files on South Australians. It is perhaps the single most important of all the papers in the 5.5 metres thick of them, as it is John under pressure, defending himself against malicious gossip, revealing his view of the times and his values. So I'm going to show you this document on the screen, courtesy of the laptop. as a good illustration of other challenges in doing his biography. And then this is where we'll finish today. And in the book, of course, I aim to address issues such as these as best as I can, not necessarily resolving them, but hopefully helping the reader understand a little bit more of John. That's the transcript, because I wanted to show what his writing looked like. This is one of the big challenges of studying John Bray. Much of what he wrote is difficult. And this is goes for a few pages with a bit crossed out. And I think the bit crossed out also is interesting, because what he said then, do I need to dig around and find out what he said and then cross out? I think perhaps not. And the other document is a transcription, so we can read it. So what John has done here is simply give an account. So we can see that, in fact, Don Dunstan asked him as early as 1965 about succeeding Sir Melis Napier. Sir Melis Napier did not want to quit. He had not the slightest intention of leaving at all. So Don worked on him and worked on him for some time, and eventually in early 1967, I think they even introduced some legislation to give him a judicial pension. But what I wanted to show was there's four patrol reports which John reacts to. The first one, number one here, it was said that at some time, apparently many years ago, police officers, something in the parklands, because Peter Ward actually did this transcription, and Peter can read John's writing better than anyone, but sometimes not always, at night, and he'd seen two men sitting in a car. I was one of them. Now, John simply says, yes, he often would be in a car at the parklands having a drink, simply because that was the only place after hours that one could have a drink. And he did drink till the late hours of the morning on a regular basis. Number two was when the police had seen him emerging. So the police saw me and a bearded man apparently rise up from the ground behind the front fence of the premises, that is his own house, brush our clothing and walk away. Now, John had a blind friend called Jack Davey, and Jack would often need help and in all sorts of conditions. So John explained that. It was a perfectly innocent explanation. Number three is perhaps a little bit more interesting and shows the scurrilousness which a police officer might come up with. It was said that on at least one occasion during the years 1959-1960, the vice squad was summoned to certain premises at 56 Hutt Street, where a number of lesbians and homosexuals, including transvestites, were involved. It was not alleged that I was present at any such occasions. And John, once again, he explains that his mother had let out the back flat to some people who were in the emergency homelessness situation, and that may well have been the case. Number four, John notes that the first three accusations were apparently made by the Commissioner of Police. In addition, it was said that the Chief Secretary had been informed that I was to be seen on most evenings after 5 o'clock drinking in a city hotel with my types. Now, he has a bit to say here about types. I do not know precisely what accusation is meant to be conveyed by the use of the word types, but my friends were and are also reputable citizens engaged in lawful occupations. Certainly many of them were and are connected with literature, the theatre, the fine arts, the teaching profession and the universities. But I cannot suppose that even a police officer or the informants of a cabinet minister regard this as a disqualification. Now then he really has his say about this lamentable episode. So this is perhaps where the seed of the issue of the police files that started to slowly simmer from then on until the 1970s when the commissioner was sacked. John did wonder about who might have been behind it. So let's have a look. It's, as the charges seem to centre around a period during which I was professionally engaged in litigation which was likely to be displeasing to the government of the day, I'm included, probably that's not correct, I'm inclined to prefer the latter supposition. If that is correct, it can be hardly thought that the police would have had me watched and my activities noted on their own initiative. Equally, I find it almost impossible to believe that the Commissioner of Police would have approached the Chief Secretary. I believe that he was prompted to do this. Various suggestions have been made to me, and I have engaged in speculation on my own as to who the prompter, the identity of the prompter. I've decided, however, to pursue the matter no further. Now, he says here, which is what I think I want to finish on today and give John the final word, I have thought it wise, however, to record the matter because of the fallibility of human memory, and in order that it should, if I still think fit, be preserved for history after the present generation is dead, as a reminder of the brazenness, the meanness and the malignancy of men, and that the price of liberty is eternal vigilance. Anyway, so that's where I want to finish. Thank you.
Now throw it open to questions, if anyone has any questions or points they want to put to John.
Yes, can I ask a question about the memories of the people that you might be speaking to in the compiling of this biography? And I have very limited experience with this sort of work, but when you come across people who knew him personally, but you have some doubts about the accuracy of their memory, what do you do?
Tread with caution. Going right back to that extensive interview with Brian Medlin, it has to be filtered very cautiously because Brian had a very particular view of the world, which in his case was filtered through a very far left-wing ideology. And he continually, in fact, pushed the interview towards him. So I had to try and pull it back towards John. And I've noticed this with other people in each and every case, and even myself, I think, if someone interviewed me about someone I knew, you're always inclined to say things in a certain way. And I think the best documentation, if you can get it, is the written documentation, particularly stuff which was written without perhaps the idea that it might be seen later, because it's always is a little bit difficult.
Could you enlarge a little on what you said about the quality of John's poetry, and particularly I'd be interested in whether you've had any assessments of it from the Adelaide poets of that time. You mentioned Brian Medlin, but other poets of that period were certainly, I would have thought, influenced by John, and I'd be very glad to hear what you found in that field.
It's true. When I first discovered that John wrote poetry, I was very sceptical. I was ready to read Sunday afternoon hobby efforts, and I discovered something quite different. My only criticism of John was he didn't write as much as he perhaps, some other poets like Alex Hope of the same generation. His poetry, I think, was well received by all the other poets of the time. Judith Wright used to teach it and wrote him a letter once expressing how well the students enjoyed his poetry. If you've read it, you know it's a particular style, mixing classics and Adelaide street life almost, sometimes being a really interesting contrast. But I'm not really, I don't know if I consider myself an expert in interpreting poetry, and when I look at his poetry, I often feel a little bit unqualified to interpret it in that way. So I look for, as a biographer, I'm looking for insights into him. Often he's quite cautious about revealing too much about himself. But I think he is one of the prominent poets of South Australia of his time, and hopefully won't get forgotten. But how can we do that? I don't know.
Does his papers reveal anything about his knowledge of the private life of Chief Justice Bray when he was writing the entry on Chief Justice Way?
Way.
In the ADV entry, because the ADV entry doesn't refer to the private life of Chief Justice Way.
I don't know. I can't remember when the ADB entry that John did was actually published, and it might have been before. I think it was some Alex Castle was one of the very first people that tracked that down and discovered Samuel Way's five children, which he'd carefully hidden. Even though he died in 1916, I really think it was only the 1980s or so when Alex Castles went down to Tasmania tracking down shipping registers for a completely different reason, and discovered that Samuel Way had travelled from Adelaide to Tasmania in 9-month cycles. So, five times, in fact. And that caused curiosity, and then of course, he looked up records and found more. So I don't know if John knew. But then again, if John knew, was it, who did the biography? Was it Ralph? The biography of Way. Who did the biography of Way?
Hannon,
that's right. Hannon knew. And Hannon, as far as I understand, did detail all of that, but then was stopped at the point of publication and it was removed. So if John had known Hannon, perhaps he may have known. But John was quite private, so he may have decided to respect that privacy. He certainly, when the John Bray Law Chapter, Wilf, when you were editor of the Portrait of John Bray, he was still alive, I think, when plans for that began, or at least talk about it began in 1994 or so, and he was very, very against it. But then again, he left all his papers, and I think it shows that he was happy for people to explore him once he was no longer around. But no, I don't know.
John, is there any particular stories associated with Bray's unsuccessful applications for academic posts? Do you know why he was not back?
I think the single thing that stands out from each and every one of his applications is they are appalling. He almost tries to talk them out. He says, "I'm short-sighted, I'm clumsy, I'm not this, I'm not that." It's just the most, it's the worst salesmanship you ever did see.
Yes, and perhaps the appointments committee felt that he could probably look after himself in some other vocation as a lawyer, whereas paid might be better. But I was going to ask a general question to John, and that is, are you writing this book entirely for a South Australian audience, or do you think that it will have readership outside the state? And if so, how would you get there?
That's a good question, Wilf, because I've always hoped to try and interest people. As I'm writing, I'm trying to write for people who actually don't know South Australia, with the hope that someone from outside South Australia might read it, simply as part of my overall secret plan to contest the idea of Ned Kelly and people like that being the only Australians that deserve to be recorded.
I had one query. John was very much of his time. Is there anything in his papers at all to indicate his attitude to women? I think he would have been classed as one of the male chauvinists around at the time. That's certainly my memory of him. Mm. But is there any documentation regarding this?
I think it's interesting. There was, I think his closest female friend was Pam Cleland, and Pam wrote at least one or two letters which he kept thanking John in the warmest terms you could possibly imagine for the confidence he gave her, because she began, I think, in 1957 with John's law firm, when women really had a hard time getting in. And I think John was the one who convinced Genders and Wilson to let her in. But then he also convinced her to just be herself, which is what she really thanked him for, beyond being a lawyer. But I know from Samela Harris, I think Samela knew John well, but she did say to me he had no interest in her whatsoever until she was an adult, because she'd often trail along with Max at various functions, and he just ignored her totally until she, I think she went to London and then came back. But he, it's true he didn't have a lot to do with women, but it may have just been a massive shyness. It's not really obvious sometimes. As some of you may or may not know, John did actually have a son, and that was not found out until 1976, including by the son. So he did, you know, he did at least have one intimate relation there, and that was in 1936. While he was doing his doctorate and working and carousing and everything, he still found time somehow. But his son does not wish to be identified. So in the book, if I need to mention him, I've decided to call him Douglas. Generally, he seemed to prefer blokes. It's true.
You were saying about the trip to France and England and that. Did he retain any correspondence with people overseas that would make it more interesting for overseas readers to read the biography?
Not from that trip, but certainly from a later trip. He went overseas only four times in his life, which was 1937, 1974, 1976, and 1978. And in 1974, he did meet people whom he then maintained regular correspondence with. But I can't track them, and they may well be gone. He also corresponded with a Greek poet called Miranda Murat. And Miranda, he met at a writer's week here in the mid-1960s. Miranda ended up going back to Greece, and when the colonels took over Greece, she was locked up because she challenged their authority, and John tried as best as he could by the time he was Chief Justice to try and secure her release. And I think in 1974, when he himself went to Greece, just at the time as the Turks came in and took over Cyprus, which is not much change, I think, for at least up until recently. He saw a lot of the problems caused by the dictatorship, and I think he did get to see Miranda, who by this stage had been released, looking very frail. But most of his people that he contacted with were very much Australian.
Perhaps we should draw the formal proceedings to a close at this stage. I'd certainly very much like to thank you, John, for your presentation today. It's been absolutely fascinating, and I'm sure, particularly to those of us who can remember John Bray, but even to those who are too young to be able to recall his incredible influence on South Australia. I'm sure I'm not the only person here who will be waiting with bated breath for publication of your book. And when it does appear, I'm sure you have sales guaranteed to pretty well everyone here, and that we're all waiting anxiously to read the final version.